Welcome, dear listener. You're listening to the Dot 2 podcast from Castorbis. This week, we are beginning a look at Chris Chibnall's time with Doctor Who, a sort of commemoration of his stewardship of the show, but also to look at how things have developed when he's been writing, not just being in charge, but going all the way back to 2007's episode 42. James McLean joins me, Christian Corley. We're going to hit play. This is a commentary. We're going to talk over it. So if you want to queue your own copy of 42 up, or if you just want to listen, either way, that's fine. But if you are going to queue up your DVD or iPlayer or however else you're going to watch it, we're going to count you in. So we'll hit pause here, then go and get your disc or load up iPlayer or whatever, and then unpause. There you go. You've unpaused. So we're going to count down. James is going to count us in, aren't you?
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Okay. Are you ready, listener? 4, 2, 1.
Why did you start with 4?
Because it's 42. So I thought.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. All right.
Well, it's not good, is it? It's it's lame. It's lame. However, as adopting one of your bad segues go, this episode to me isn't lame. I actually rather like this one.
Yeah, it's a long time since I've watched it, to be honest, but I never disliked it. I've always enjoyed watching it. I can't remember any of this pre-credit sequence, though, at all.
People seem to be in two camps over it. They tend to sort of be either they like it or they think it's just very dull.
Yeah. And why is that, do you think?
I'm not entirely sure, to be honest, because I thought at the time it was... Well, it wasn't an original concept, because there's a few people who had been riffing off 24.
Yeah, yeah. Because it's the real-time concept, isn't it?
The real-time concept, yeah, hadn't been done in Doctor Who. So I thought, in a sense, that was innovative for the actual format for the show. I thought the cast was good. I think what struck me most about this and carried me through liking it for a long time after was that I thought Murray Gold's score was exciting and bombastic and really elevated what I think otherwise could have been quite a flat show.
Right.
So I think it's a good example when you get a good music, when you get a good composer really being able to sort of lift the action up. Because ultimately, it's a very confined space. There's obviously not much space for the camera to move in a lot of scenes. It's quite at the moment, as we're seeing in these opening shots, it's all quite tight and it's intentionally tight. And I think, yeah, I mean, even the big sort of action moments, as we'll see later with the escape pod, are actually fairly static events. Even the actual escape pod moving is slow,
yeah.
And so it's the music which actually elevates it and keeps it going. So, I mean, obviously I'm aware this is more about Chibnall than Gold, but I think it's a good example of where, well, you know, that television is a collaborative process and it's very awkward for lame middle-aged podcasters to be sort of focusing on one authorial voice when we're sort of seeing an example of where the collaboration is what makes the end result.
So, opening titles.
And now we're into titles. Yep.
Which are very... I mean, if you compare them with today's opening titles, it feels, because of the speed, it's like a rush to get on with the story, isn't it, basically? And they're quite short as well.
Yeah. I'm not over keen with today's titles. I like the idea behind them, but there's occasionally... It's a weird one because there's a sort of symmetry thing going on, which is then deliberately just shown to be not symmetrical.
Mm.
But it kind of feels too much like it is symmetrical, and it kind of therefore reminds me it's an effect. There's a weird, it doesn't quite work for me, and the music, it doesn't sort of excite me. But then Chibnall, I think one thing we can say about Chibnall, as we've said before, he does like to tap into his love of the show. And I get the feeling with the opening titles, you're getting a far more 60s vibe.
Yes, definitely.
Which is what he's trying to tap into. Which is interesting again, because I think the positive thing about Chibnall is that he is so entrenched in the same style of writing as, say, Stephen Moffat is. Whether you think Stephen Moffat is a far better writer or not, I think I mean, this is nothing like what you'd see in the first season of Whittaker's.
No, it's not.
42 fits very much the Russell T Davies flow. And again, you could say, well, how much is that to do with Chibnall being a writer here and not actually the show, to use the glib, you know, the term, the showrunner, who is overseeing and editing scripts? It takes me back watching this. Back in the days.
Yeah. It's directed by Graham Harper, of course, who we spoke to a few years ago.
Which, again, is another point about the collaborative process, isn't it? That, you know, so much of this is to do with the director, perhaps less so than obviously with film, but in television, you know, he's still a very powerful voice in this.
And of course, you've got the design element as well, haven't you? The designers play a part.
Yeah, absolutely.
Everything from the set to the typeface on the computer displays.
I mean, I've always loathed the idea of sort of trying to find that single voice in collaborative mediums like television and film. And yet here we are looking at a singular voice. So, I mean, looking at the singular voice, I think that the minor characters didn't particularly blow me away in this. I didn't really care. But then I don't think this sort of story is designed to really make you care, because there's just not enough time.
No.
The whole point of it is it's fast moving. So where do you really start to hammer in? So in the end, you have to rely on having a good cast. And funny enough, I was talking about this last night regarding Blake Seven. And, you know, there's a Twitter account making Blake Seven, which does some really good breakdowns of every episode.
Are they got breakdowns or Blake Downs?
Blake Downs. We'll go with Blake Downs.
Okay.
Middle aged. I'm sure the children would laugh at that. The Blake Downs of these episodes were sort of, and they sort of talk about the frictions in the cast and the genuine concern of the female cast members. They weren't used appropriately. And something like Blake Seven is very much about dialogue and about characterizations, which really sort of made it what it was. And I think, again, a lot of the time, and this is my point here, is it's so much to do with casting. If you get the right cast members, the dialogue doesn't matter so much. And I think here we've got some pretty good cast members by and large. They've got a good guest cast, which I think make the characters maybe not memorable, but certainly distinctive. And that's what you need in this.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, in this scene, we've got Vinette Robinson, who played Rosa Parks in Chris Chibnall's first series.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Nice link. I don't know. Well, we did have Wikipedia back then, as we do now, so.
Well, no, I'd have had to do it completely from memory in those days.
I think the other thing I like about this episode, which again wasn't really done, particularly in the Davies era, is the vulnerability of the Doctor, which we see later on. There was a sort of, obviously, as we know, in the Davies era especially, there was an elevation of what the Doctor was, the lonely god. And here we see a slight inversion, which still does what Davies likes and has the focus on the companion as having a key, you know, driver and as a key cipher for the audience.
Yeah.
But in a weird way, it sort of kind of does a sort of new adventure-y thing and sort of weakens the Doctor to elevate the companion's relevance in the story. And yet at the same time, doesn't take the Doctor out and does not take away his agency. And I think that's what I really liked about it. I think Tennant did this really well and played the levels of the Doctor in this, from the authority to his usual energy to the fragility to the agony. He does really well.
I find again, he's good in series 3 and series 4. Series 2 is obviously just finding his feet, and there's a few of them I'm not that keen on, not just so much the stories but some of his performances. But in 3 and 4 he's superb, and the specials.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's the thing with Doctor Who that people seem to always forget when a new Doctor comes. It takes them a season find their feet, which is just the sad thing with Eccleston, really, is that he only had the season to find his feet. But you look at Matt Smith in his final season to his first. I mean, he's still very good in his first, to be fair to that guy. But you can tell by the final season, he's just wearing that character like a glove.
Yeah.
It's interesting, isn't it, that later we get a break away from this, but there was a lot of the industrial future, wasn't there, at this period?
Yes, there was, yeah. Yeah. No, that's a good point, actually, because you've got Utopia later on as well, haven't you, which is...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, there's many which, you know, you look at the Satan Pit, they're all sort of this sort of utopias, lack of utopias. Dystopias,
yes.
Or just simply just industrial futures. The only one that springs to mind which isn't is obviously End of the World. And again, that's a lot to do with budget.
You watch more TV than me, I think it's fair to say. Was this a common look at the time on other shows, or was it something that had already been done on other shows, particularly US shows?
I think obviously Alien inspired this avenue quite considerably. And it's invariably far cheaper for television to sort of go into an industry space than it is to actually build a sort of sci-fi, futuristic set. So you can see why this sort of setting was popular. I mean, I can think back to Doctor Who in the 90s, you know, when you'd have the non-Doctor Who, Doctor Who's like Shakedown, which was done on VHS and was a springboard for Doctor Who, which wasn't Doctor Who, but was continuing on Terence Dix's New Adventures, Sontaran's story. And that, again, had that same sort of industry feel because it was easy for them to get on board a ship and do it in the bowels of the ship. So I think that is why, at this point, certainly still we're seeing that. It's a very easy future to do. And for a lot of people, it's a very believable future.
Yeah.
I think as soon as you've got futures where everything's clean, people start to question the look far more than like this. And this sort of stuff doesn't age as well, because you know, when people are in hot, steamy places, they're going to be wearing T-shirts. They're not going to be wearing spandex and tin foil.
So a couple of things in this scene are highlighting themselves to me. There's angry Francine, who seems to be in a bad mood apart from the last 10 minutes of the last episode of this series. And flip phones, which are just coming back into fashion, which is incredible.
But yeah, I mean, I won't say this episode was ever one that was ever going to break Doctor Who. And I think sometimes it's always good to have series, you know, episodes which don't. Episodes which can just you know, tell an interesting story.
Yeah.
I mean, invariably, like with the Davis era, we've still obviously got the drop-ins to contemporary England and the ongoing Saxon story there, which I never liked. I know it was very much of the vogue of the time, you know, obviously following on from the success of Buffy, which was clearly inspiration. But this story would be far nicer if it didn't have the phone calls home, even though at one point coming up, which is quite important from a character moment.
You can kind of see it from Francine's point of view, though, if a dog is swanning off, making odd phone calls, ignoring her messages, and then there's a unworldly scream at the end of the call.
It's interesting in terms of, I know it's very much... talking away from Chibnall, but again, how tight the sets are, bar the medical bay. So all those shots are all very, very close. Lots of tight stuff going on. I think that's another good thing about Chibnall is that he tends to sort of have an idea, or seems to have an idea of scope, which is relative to what the show can do. And this is an episode which works very much on its own, never spoken about ever since. You can see from a pitch point of view that it would work, because you've got a limited cast, you've got aesthetically the same space throughout, so you know you can match that fairly well. You're not having to build or get different design spaces. You know, from a producing point of view, this is, you know, pretty good for Doctor Who. And at the time, it was nice because obviously we remember the first series, there was all the complaints about it all being set on Earth. And then come season two, there's still a lot set on Earth. And it was very nice to get ones which were set away from the planet.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed ones where they sort of were on spaceships.
That's interesting. According to Wikipedia, the title of the episode was chosen as an homage to The Answer to Life, the Universe and Everything from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I'd always assumed it was just a flip of 24.
I suspect it's more likely. But there's no reason why it couldn't be both.
Oh.
I mean, I think 42 is, and Douglas Adams is more of a sort of lucky. I mean, there's no doubt this is based on 24. That's where its play is.
Yeah, yeah. And we just hit 24:51 just to underline that.
Yeah.
And Michelle Collins was an interesting choice at the time because she was more well known as a soap actress.
Yeah, it's a. Sorry, what was that?
I was going to say Michelle Collins was better known as a soap actress, wasn't she? Whereas these days she probably isn't so much. So it was a bit. There's always been a little bit of a snobbiness from some Doctor Who fans, a lot of Doctor Who fans, older Doctor Who fans perhaps, with regards to casting people from soaps in Doctor Who.
But that's what Doctor Who has done since the
70s. Well, I mean, look
at. Deal with it.
Yeah, Fiona Agyeman was in Crossroads. It's not a huge, thing, is it? I mean, it's acting.
I was going to say, did those same Doctor Who fans, and again, making a caricature here, were they, you know, is it about an actor who you know taking you out of it? Is it about the acting? Because you can't say that John Cleese intentionally wasn't bringing anything that which was embedded in the story. It was a moment to directly pull you out of the story. It was a joke moment. You know, would have the same fury if he had appeared in, I suppose it's in the same tone of episode, but I just kind of feel, as you say, there is a sort of classism going on there, sort of snobbishness about soaps.
Yeah.
Ironically from sci-fi fans.
I think it probably is what it is. That is the case.
I thought Collins was good in this, and I think that's always a nice surprise, isn't it? You go into something and you go, oh no, I know that face. I can't imagine them in this scenario, regardless of where they're from. And they go, oh, actually, they're good.
I mean, ultimately, soap operas are as silly as sci-fi, aren't they? They're just silly in a completely different way. So.
Yeah. Got to be careful of these dead spaces.
That's a video game series,
isn't
it? Dead Space. Set on a
space. Was that, sorry?
This Dead Space is a video game series, isn't it? Set on a abandoned spaceship.
Oh, there we go. There's the link.
Hmm.
Yeah, Burma with me. That was very much the key to this episode. It's a nice line. I like it.
It's better than delete.
Yeah, but I think the idea, I think the fact that it's again going back to the writing, it's someone who's writing who's really tapping into what the show is doing at the time and how the format is working. And these two catchphrases are less to be so necessarily to be scary, but they're sort of very much part. The phrases are very much a part of identifying the monster, aren't they? You know, as you say, the delete, the exterminate, burn with me. And in a weird way, that was very much part of the revival. Yeah, I mean, it's a genre piece. It's doing exactly what it's meant to be doing. I don't think there's anything that I can really fault it in. I mean, even this escape pod sequence is really well done. Again, it's not simply Chibnall. That's down to the editing. It's down to the direction. It's down to the music.
Yeah,
it all comes together in a piece which isn't that expensive. Isn't that fast moving? But I found, to be honest, in this season was one of the most, energized moments of the revelation of the Master and in Utopia.
Yeah.
Look in terms of production. You've got your set. You've got your location to film this. You put in a few, I don't know, I assume sort of carbon dioxide or whatever pumping out, and you light it, and you've got your ship. That's why these places were popular.
Also, it makes a difference to using underneath the Millennium Stadium in Cardiff, which they used for a lot of episodes this time, yeah.
They did, Steve. So that was that. I mean, that can be, as you say, it can pull you out of the moment when you spot it. And they're doing that for years. You know, even down to River Song's prison was down those corridors, wasn't it? As I recall.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, it gives it a unique look. It gives it a feeling of, that you're in the moment. I think the ship design as well, and I think quite clever how the ship design is very largely, as they put it in this, it's sections. So it's like a corridor of sections. And that sort of is obviously mimicked in the exterior shots of it. It all just comes together very well. It explains itself very well. The situation is very simple and straightforward to understand. It has this sort of clocks pacing to it, which I think is a very smart move. It's just a very well put together story. But it's very different to say Blink. You take another show, later showrunner, and how they write to how Chibnall writes. It's a very different sort of beast. And there's room for both, and that's the beauty of Doctor Who, isn't it? I mean, I think Blink is a fantastic story, but I think this is a very good story as well, very well handled. And in the end, people will say, well, why does Doctor Who survive? And this is exactly the reason, isn't it? That you can have a trapped on a spaceship, sort of alien, and then there was one sort of approach.
Yeah.
Or you could do the sort of crazy, creepy time angels that doesn't even have the Doctor in it at all, or barely. There's such flexibility to the show, which I think Flux demonstrated as well. It still has legs, even if maybe, as we said, COVID might have shortened that story a little too much, that it didn't totally find its coherency in the end. But this is very coherent all the way through.
That use of silence as well, with the Doctor shouting at Martha there, which starts off with, we can hear him, and then it switches to Martha's point of view, and of course she can't.
Emphasizing exterior, interior, which is vital for a show like this, which is meant to be very claustrophobic.
Yeah.
At this point, it's one of those beautiful Doctor Who moments. It's like, well, how do you get out of this? And you know that they will, but it would have been a great cliffhanger, really.
Definitely.
Show. 20, well, it could have been
20, yeah, 23 20, minutes 20, through, so yeah. In the classic era.
It was an era as well which did love infections.
Yeah, I was just looking there. Apparently, the ship in the original script was called SS Icarus, but this was changed after the producers learned about the film Sunshine
Ah.
by Danny Boyle, which came out the same year.
Was it the same year?
Yeah.
God. Yeah, it's a shame because obviously it would have been perfect for this episode. I think what's quite clever about the story and how it's been written is the way that it has this pace to it. It has this time on the clock, and yet it finds reasons and moments to be able to allow characters to talk. So in the escape pod, where there's nothing they can do, the urgency is still there for the audience, and yet you've got a pocket which allows your characters to do something other than just rush around. And I think that's a really clever balance in this story, that there's a certain flow of pace and on off that culminates, obviously, for the final act into a fast running action piece. But this is nice, and I like the way there's a little bit of world building here as well in the story, which doesn't really have time to build any worlds. You get a feeling of the crew and the life on this. I think I always enjoyed these sort of future stories which did this. I liked, like Gridlock was a great one in a similar way, and again was using very similar, not the same aesthetics, but again you were looking at the sort of grittier future, even though obviously New Earth was a mixture of the two.
Yes. And Gridlock's
So of
also.
course that was problem, though. If you wanted to have nice new future, then you wouldn't go underneath Cardiff. If you just go to the Millennium Centre, you'd just be in the foyer bit. His helmet was very Return of the Jedi-ish.
It is a bit, isn't it? A bounty hunter.
Yeah, which you could get away with then, but now, of course, where Star Wars rules once more. Might have a bit of a problem. Yes, it's a good piece for Michelle Collins. It's a good piece for how hot it is, and yet Tennant's hair
Yeah.
looks mildly hot but still holds. I'm breaking that tidal gel, is there? Not even that helmet.
Cast iron.
Cast iron, yeah. So, this is, I mean, the sequence outside the ship is my favorite sequence in this episode and possibly in the season. Again, it's just the work of the music to the story to the acting to the editing, the direction. It all comes together so well here.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the stuff that's taking place in contemporary Earth, this is one of those moments. I think, is this the second moment where you get in this series that there's something going on? I think the first one's in the Lazarus
Yeah, I
experiment.
think so. Yeah, which was interesting. But again, well, again, it was a sign of the times to a degree. This was a time where, terrestrial television was still very popular. Drama shows were getting a certain bump now, as in terms of prestige, and the channels were sort of promoting them in a different way. Doctor Who was very aware that it had a following as well of different ages. And so this sort of drop in onto the story arc and sort of building to something was working not just within the show, but obviously it was working, with people watching the show, wondering who, how Saxon was going to come in. Was this the master? We knew John Sim was involved at this point. So there was a sort of feeding into that, that anticipation and energy.
This went out on the 19th of May 2007 at 7:15 p.m. But it was originally planned to go out on the 12th of May, but it's postponed because of the Eurovision Song Contest coverage. I think I can vaguely recall being slightly miffed at that.
I mean, this is a great bit of work from Harper Tennant. This works so well. I mean, again, it's just simply,
It's just pressing some
man
buttons,
reaching
isn't
for
it,
button.
really? But
Yeah, man reach for button. I always love that. I just love his go on, my son. I mean, that is just so. I don't know whether that was scripted or whether that's Tennant, but it just fits that sort of faux London character that he has. It's just so, and the sort of youthfulness of him as well. It's such pub talk. And the music, as I say, and again, it's just reaching for this damn lever and buttons, and it plays it so well. And again, like I say, Tennant just really makes it work. And again, the all the strange creatures that this is riffing off the music, this version of it was never heard again. It's slightly different to even the one that's used in Utopia, so it's very much written for this episode. I was very disappointed at the time that it never got a proper release, because it's just so bombastic, so Doctor Who, because it's exciting without it being silly or sinister. It's just got energy to it, which is what Doctor Who should have. And then, of course, it leads to this next section, this sort of final section where Tennant again acts his obviously his little socks off in a different way to what he normally does. Yeah, I love this performance, this Tennant performance. I always love performances where, lead characters, especially characters which are always in control, have that control taken away from them. It's always interesting to watch how that plays out. And, especially at the moment, imagine for kids as well to see their hero, which so far has always been in control, suddenly become a threat as well. I do wonder whether, if I was to have one criticism of this episode, or whether, again, that's a show which was, had a big kids' audience at the time, maybe that would have. And again, I think that's something which is really great about this era and the way the stories are written and overseen is the way that it taps into to cleverly into so many audiences. And I think Chibnall's been trying to replicate that in his season, whether or not you agree, one agrees it's been successful or not, but there's been a lot of variety, but then there's a lot of variety in Moffat's here as well, to be fair to him.
There's something about the. Obviously, we'll come to this next time when we deal with the Chibnall stories in the Moffat era. But there is something more. The comedic tones of kind of does tend to dominate throughout, certainly the Matt Smith episodes, I think.
I mean, in part that's because Smith plays and works so well.
Yeah.
I think also, I imagine, and we obviously, I don't know, but I imagine Moffat takes a run at the script where he will can't help himself, and that sort of writing is something he's very good at. And I'd say the one thing I'd say about Chibnall is that he's obviously he always strikes me as a very straight writer so far, as that his dialogue isn't the wittiest. It's I don't think that's where his strengths are. I could be wrong. I mean, there's stuff that Whittaker will say, which lands and is good, but is not particularly. Moffat is very good at sort of really pushing the boundaries of eccentricities in his characters in a way that I don't think really is Chibnall's strong suit. I think Davis sits in between.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
But then that's why I kind of liked Chibnall. Well, we'll get to, obviously, when we get to Chibnall's era. But one thing I liked was that sort of strip back away from that. Because sometimes clever writing can, clever dialogue or quippy dialogue, and sometimes even meta dialogue, can just pull you out and it can take away the urgency. And there's no, and I think that's why I love this next section with Tennant, because you just get that all stripped away. None of it. And I think that's why this episode is very memorable. But again, it comes back to, you know, how much does the showrunner have input in these scripts? And that will obviously vary depending on the showrunner. And it will also have depending on the relationship with the showrunner and the writer, I suspect. And also depend on the script, and also perhaps even sometimes depend on the moods of people and the time that they have. So it's always hard to gauge, you know, when people say, oh, well, Russell T. Davis would change all these scripts, or Stephen Moffat wouldn't, or would, or Stephen Moffat would get in, would try and get involved, or how many of the co-writing scripts, or, you know, the showrunner, are they involved in? You know, these are, it's an organic process of producing these sort of shows.
Mm.
You know, time's against you. You know, you're doing multiple things. That's going to affect you as a human being as well. So who knows? It'd be fascinating to know. I remember in the writer's tale, Davis sort of acknowledging that sometimes reflecting back, he would be perhaps sometimes let his emotions and his frustrations vent on when dealing with writers. I think that's a very honest thing to say.
Yeah, I'm being drawn into the story here. There's a lot of running up and down corridors.
Yeah, there is. And I think another thing to point out, which sort of obviously affects people's opinions on writers, is, again, whether the show, what the show brings to the writing. So, for instance, Doctor Who gives a lot of scope, and you kind of know, and if you have a good showrunner as well, you kind of know what you're meant to be bringing. So under Davis here, this feels very much in tone with Davis's era. But you take Chibnall's work in Torchwood, and I feel that one of the problems which weakened some of Chibnall's work there maybe is that the show just didn't know what it was doing. It was just not confident in itself. And I think that made it very hard for some of those episodes to really pay off, and probably a lot harder for writers to be able to do their job. But whether you like this story or not, it's tight. It's tight all the way through. It's confident, it knows what it's doing. It has drama, it has characterizations, it has good moments. There's some lovely moments. The ejection of Michelle Collins' character is, you know, yep. the slowdown of it, and then the shot of them heading towards the sun. You know, it's a lot of surprisingly good art moments within a story which is just, you know, being pushed by the clock. And again, we've gone back, you know, we go back to the Strange Creatures music, which again really helps push this forward and give that sort of urgency. I mean, this is the first time I noticed the motif. I mean, it appears in Gridlock, but it appears in a far more stripped back. I think it appears in Gridlock still. But this was the first time I was like, okay, this music's really, kicking us up a notch. It's such a weird hybrid, the story of A New Adventures and Russell T Davies Who.
It is, it is.
The Doctor stripped back of his power in the story, and his agency shifts to being malevolent, which is very much like New Adventures, yet the pace and tone of everything is as far away from New Adventures as you'd probably get in some respect. I mean, this is perhaps the one area of the set design where I don't think it works, is I don't think this bridge section really speaks bridge. It's far too industrialized.
Yeah.
With switches and controls which are just far too contemporary.
And wheels.
And of course, yeah,
wheels.
Valves.
Yes, valves. Yeah. Taps.
Some stickers. But then the way it deals with that is it was what Harper seems to do is he keeps everything tight again, doesn't he? Everything's tight, so you're not getting a good look at it. So you're not really sort of being drawn away into what it actually is. Getting all these close shots of all the controls, close shot of Martha on this sort of central pedestal which they've designed.
I think what's interesting about this science, in quotes, inverted commas, you've got a sun that's sentient using its own natural power to draw the ship in, its own natural gravity to draw the ship in, which I think is quite interesting. It's not the first time we've seen sentient suns in Doctor Who. I doubt it'll be the last time either. We obviously had one in that episode with Clara and the Leaf, which I call Clara and the Leaf, even though it's, what was it, the Rings of Akaten?
Rings of Akaten.
Yeah. Although Clara and the Leaf could be a story about a girl and an eco-friendly car, I suppose.
Yes, is as much energy as I can muster to that. Yes. Good. It could be just that, Christian. Yes. I think also the thing I like about this is it reminded me a bit of the old style Doctor Who in, the TARDIS lands somewhere. You have an adventure and then you go back to the TARDIS. And you didn't always get that. Because Doctor Who was becoming, a new thing at this point. It was trying new things. And, Blink would be coming up shortly. And again, there would be something different in the format. When I first watched the new series, I was very keen on these sort of TARDIS land somewhere, have an adventure, leave again, because it just reminded me of the old show.
I should probably reiterate that this was episode 7 in series 3. Series 3 is probably, I really like series 4 and series 1, but series 3 is probably my favourite of the Davies era. This is 42. The previous experiment was the Lazarus experiment. Sorry, the previous episode was the Lazarus experiment, which, not everyone's a fan of. I enjoy it. Following 42, you've got Human Nature, The Family of Blood, Blink, Utopia, The Sound of Drums, and Last of the Time Lords.
Big run, isn't it?
It's a superb run of episodes, yeah.
Yeah, it was a slow season. Smith and Jones, I wasn't overly keen on. Had things like Shakespeare's Code again. Didn't massively work for me. It didn't. You've got Daleks Take Manhattan, which again has got issues. It takes a while for this season to sort of find its feet. Gridlock, I think, is excellent. So Gridlock and then 42, I think, as you say, from 42 onwards, the back end of the season is just very powerful. And while I know that people have a lot of issues with its finale, I still think it's got some good stuff in there. But I think, again, as a bit of writing, this does not stick out as not feeling out of, does not feel out of character where this season's going.
No.
It works really well. I mean, if you told me this was a Russell T Davies written episode, I'd probably go, okay, I could see that. And I think that's important when writers have that sort of synchronization with what is wanted from them. And I think in the next commentary we'll do on the Moffat era, I think that's true there. I think that fits very well with what Moffat's doing at the time. Yeah, I like the season. But yeah, season four was very good. Yeah, season four. Season one, season four. A couple of the specials were excellent. Those are my, and yeah, I've got Blink Next, yeah, of course. Which I watched recently and was, oh no, it's not just Human Nature, isn't it? Sorry. Human Nature, which I haven't watched in ages. Which was good, but I always had a little issue with it because I was very much into Paul Cornell's original novel.
Yeah.
So it was always a bit of a overly comparing rather than seeing it as it actually was.
So yeah, so
But
that
it
is
was.
42, which, like all of current Doctor Who, can be enjoyed on BBC iPlayer. If you're looking for older stuff, you would have to look on BritBox or Amazon to buy the DVDs and Blu-rays of the reissued collections. Do you think we've learned anything watching Chris Chibnall's first televised Doctor Who story?
No.
It's just so very
Well, I,
different, isn't it, to what he
yeah, I mean,
actually produced as a showrunner?
I think what I've learned from it is a reminder that even though it's a Chibnall episode, its success comes from its collaborative edit, elements. But I don't think you could ignore that it's got a, you know, obviously the writing is the core, and the writing's good throughout. The characters work. The tone is good. I mean, if you look at that all the way through, the tone is correct. There's never any point where it slips out. Those concerns about Chibnall being preachy, which you hear a lot of these days, there's no preachiness in it. It does what it's meant to do. And yes, you can argue that's because you've got a showrunner who knows what they want, who get the writer to do the story they think suits the writer, or the writer will be able to do. Because most of the time, as far as I'm aware, sort of the story concepts with Davis, which he would then farm out rather than people bringing the ideas to him. But I could be wrong in this case. But yeah, I just think it's a good example of collaborative television. And I think it's a good example of Chris Chibnall doing good television. And I think that's the thing. I mean, again, if you look at Flux, I suppose the point of this comment, these commentaries is to sort of not sort of celebrate Chibnall. But to sort of try and sort of flesh out away from the sort of hyperbole and sort of statements which are made about people in television. And sort of say, look, you know, you can't just say that Stephen Moffat can't write characters. You can't say that all Davis's stuff is fairy tales. You can't say that Chibnall's stuff is too preachy and doesn't, you know, he doesn't know Doctor Who. You've got to sort of get away from that and sort of look at this stuff and say, well, what are they bringing here? What are these professionals bringing in this collaboration? I think 42 is a good example of professionals collaborating very well. And are we doing the Silurians for the next for the Moffat era? Is it the
Well, I was
one?
just looking at Chibnall's, because at the time this came out, he was, of course, producing Torchwood, quite producing isn't the right word, but he's very heavily involved with Torchwood. So, and he wrote Day One, Cyberwoman, Countryside, End of Days, Kiss Kiss Bang Bang in Series 2 of Torchwood, Adrift, Fragments, and Exit Wounds. And so, yeah, he's it's there's this kind of impression, this kind of narrative given by certain watchers of Doctor Who with intense appreciation of some things but not so much of others, that Chris Chibnall isn't much of a writer. Now he's that's just one's that's t so 8 or 9 episodes from one show there. He wrote 2 episodes for Life on Mars, the only writer aside from the creators of the show, Matthew Graham and Ashley Ferry, to write on both series, episode 7 in series 1 and episode 2 in series 2. And then you've got 42, The Hungry Earth and Cold Blood, which we'll come to later, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, The Power of Three, The Woman Who Fell to Earth, and the rest of his episodes in the in his era running the series. He is a good writer because we've also got that very famous TV show starring David Tennant and Olivia Colman that he created and wrote. So, I do get frustrated with the idea that Chris Chibnall is not a good writer, because he clearly is a good writer, and 42 is an excellent episode. We are going to be looking at Hungry Earth and Cold Blood next time, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's a nice, interesting shift in genre. As you say, we've got a different showrunner.
Yep.
Showrunner is working under a different type of Doctor Who. I'm kind of looking forward to rewatching those.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a six-year gap between The Power of Three in 2012 and The Woman Who Fell to Earth in 2018, which is obviously mainly due to Broadchurch.
But I think it's interesting, if we had a longer series, and if we cared, and there is a limit of how much you can care about this time television show, and we looked at Torchwood as well. I mean, I think Cyberwoman is a fascinating one, because I think that's an example of where you do actually have a fairly good story, good writing, but it's the way it's put together that doesn't quite work.
Hmm.
And an example of where the collaborative process fails. I remember watching Cyberwoman and actually really enjoying it, but could understand where the certain design elements were just letting the story down.
I remember watching Cyberwoman and enjoying it, and I didn't really understand why. I could see why you wouldn't be maybe enjoy it as much as I did, but I couldn't understand some of the criticism it was getting. So
it got a lot of hate, yeah, because I was the first Torchwood. I was thinking, actually, this is actually quite powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think a lot of people couldn't get past the costume design.
Yeah.
I think that was largely the big issue. But the point being is the story, I thought, was very strong. Countryside wasn't really my sort of thing, but it had its moments.
I'm thinking about Countryside. Wasn't Owen Teal in that one? Yes, he was, yeah.
I mean, at that point, I was thinking, I don't think Torchwood really knows what it is, and I don't think it did. But which, again, you could argue is down to Chibnall to some degree. But I thought, in terms of tone and story, he could work it well.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it's all about the collaboration, and I think this series, while we're looking at Chibnall stuff, is going to be a lot of it identifying that, you know, television is not an author, it's not a book. You know, the mistakes and the successes cannot be put down to one person. They must be shared.
And they can't easily be revised with a second edition, can they?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And also, because it's multiple, it's very hard to actually isolate when it's someone's fault and why it's someone's fault. And given it's a far more, you know, it's a commercial collaborative process, it's very hard to sort of to even say that someone has just not done their homework. There's just so many things that are going on. So many time pressures, financial pressures, problems that occur that you cannot anticipate, that you've got to resolve because you've got that set time to do these sort of things. Television is a very unkind medium, and I think it's, unfortunately, people who watch it, not because they're being nasty, but just because that sort of stuff is invisible, don't really sort of, you know, aren't that aware of those sort of things when they make their judgments, which tend to be on singular people, the main actor or the writer.
Yeah.
So
we'll leave it there. As ever, let us know your thoughts. And any of them are of particular relevance to what we've discussed, we may bring them up next time. In the next podcast, we will be looking at The Hungry Earth. So if you are keen on following us through with our discussions, cue your DVD/iPlayer for that next time. Until then, it's goodbye from us.